This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. North Carolina Central University has a new endowed professor of art on campus. Her name is Beverly McKeever, and her appointment to the art department is a bit of a homecoming. The university is not only her alma mater, it's where Beverly McKeever learned to paint and where she found the courage to begin her journey as an artist. Before college, Beverly grew up with her mother and two sisters in a poor neighborhood in Greensboro. There she witnessed violence at the hands of the Ku Klux Klan and struggled with an identity crisis based on race and gender. In high school, she found comfort performing as a clown. After graduating from North Carolina Central, Beverly left the state. Her troubled memories made returning home one of the biggest challenges of her adult life. But thankfully, she did return. Beverly McKeever is the new SunTrust Bank Professor of Art at North Carolina Central University and joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Was it hard coming home for you?
It was hard to come home, in part because I initially thought of growing up in the projects and in Greensboro, and I thought about being poor, and I thought that if I came back, it would just be the same old thing.
Tell us about that, about growing up in Greensboro. Where was it, and what was it like?
Well, me and my two sisters and my mom grew up, my mom raised us in Morningside Homes, which is in Greensboro, and it's a housing project, so it was really poor. And our neighbor was found in the dumpster, killed, and was just never solved. The problem was, you know, it never was resolved as to who killed her and how she ended up in the dumpster. And then in 1979, the KKK came through and shot and killed five people right out in front of our apartment. In fact, our car got shot.
So, and you saw that, and how old were you?
I was actually not at home. I was at McDonald's working, and I was 17 at the time. But my mother witnessed the entire thing and was subpoenaed to testify against the KKK at the trial, in which they were all acquitted.
How were you taking it at the time? Is this had you numbed yourself to this kind of thing, or is it continually shocking each one of these episodes?
It was continually shocking. I mean, I think that regardless of how many times, you know, we found someone on our steps who had been stabbed or hurt and was begging for help, and we were afraid to open the door. You just never get used to that. You never get used to seeing another human being get killed. So it was difficult. And I just thought, you know, this is horrible because I had this sort of existence at home. And then I was bused across town to predominantly white schools where, you know, everybody was middle class and planning to go to college. And, you know, so there was this sort of, I got this warped sense of, you know, white was right and, you know, black was bad.
What was that doing to your sense of self at the time? I mean, were you conscious of the fact that you, I'm guessing, had to disguise who you were or somehow cover up the fact that you came from that place, did you? And
of course. Yeah. Of course. I mean, I would, when a friend would drive me home, I would have them drop me off at someone else's house that I didn't even know just because I was not taking them to the projects. And of course, you know, that led in high school, I joined the clown club and put on white grease paint and literally, you know, a blonde wig and became white.
Clowns, of course, a very important part of your art. We know that from seeing the portraits that you've done. But you were very serious about clowning at the time. You were going to join the circus.
That's right. I actually did tryouts for Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus when they came to Greensboro and was not accepted.
Now, you can easily see this as a way, you know, if you take two steps back and watch the development of Beverly McKeever after the stories you've told just now, easy to see how you're trying to hide and disguise your identity. Was it clear to you? Did you see that that's what was going on with you, or just want to be a clown?
Yeah, I didn't see at the time. I mean, you know, hindsight is a beautiful thing. And so at the time, I thought that I was, I felt as a clown, that I was my most authentic self, not recognize that I had changed, you know, made myself white and wore a blonde wig and covered up every part of my black skin. So, it was later that I discovered that that's what I was doing.
All of this happening at a time when there's another reality going on right under your roof. Your sister, Renee, was mentally disabled.
That's correct.
And you took a big part of the responsibility of raising her, even when she was at home with your mom.
Yes. Renee is my oldest sister and was always, you know, depending on how Renee felt, was whether or not we got to go outside and play or, you know, if we went, you know, to dinner out or anything. So Renee was on a lot of medication as a child growing up to try to control her epilepsy and also, you know, the raging hormones of any teenager. So, you know, it made her difficult to be with.
So there you are. You have the aspirations to be a clown. You did, though, end up going to college. You went to North Carolina Central.
I did.
And you were a psych major.
I was a psychology major and, originally.
What were your intentions going in?
To help myself and others.
And just to get out. So what was happening to clowning at the time? Had you dropped that entirely?
No. I clowned as a college student. I worked for a balloon company in Durham and delivered balloons and sang songs to people in hospitals and did birthday parties and things like that to make some money. So I was still a clown, and I was still white-face.
Yeah.
Still white-face.
But you're going to school. You're taking the psych courses now, so you have a little, few analytical tools, apart from grease paint and a bulbous nose, to investigate yourself. And you have a very important moment with a college, with a professor who turned your life around.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, I was a psych major, but I took an art course because as an elective. And that's when I met Elizabeth Lentz, who was my painting teacher. And she just changed my whole life. I mean, she told me that if you work hard at this, you can be good at it, you know, and you can make it. And, you know, right words at the right time. And I needed something to believe in.
Did you believe it right away?
I think I did believe it right away. I mean, because she was, you know, she was the kind of person that would let me come to her house and paint with her and, you know, would always let me paint at home and I could bring extra paintings in. And she was always very attentive and looking and, you know, just encouraging me and saying, you know, I think you got it.
Wow. What made you take the course in the first place?
Well, I've always liked art. And I did do some drawing when I was in high school, but I never took a painting class until I went to North Carolina Central University. So I thought, well, I'll try painting.
What kind of things were you painting at the time?
I was doing self-portraits at the time and still lives, lots of still lives, because the teacher wanted me to paint from observation and to learn how to see like an artist sees. And so all of that was done through setting up still lives, lemons, apples, and painting what was in front of me.
Now, you have said that all of the portraits that you do are, in a sense, self-portraits.
That's correct.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when I'm walking around, I look at people's faces and, you know, I'm analyzing and I just trust my intuition. If I'm drawn to them, then I suspect that it's either they possess a part of who I am or they possess something that I would like to have in my own personality. And so I'm interested in painting those people. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether they're white or black or, you know, male or female or whatever. You know, intuitively, if I'm drawn to them, I'm interested in painting them to as a self-portrait.
And you've done a series of portraits as clowns, people in makeup.
Yes,
so that's,
I have.
It was at least important to you at the time. Do you see yourself sort of developing through all of this, or are these themes somehow still integrated into your work?
Well, what's happened with the clown image is that, you know, I painted myself initially in whiteface, and then after seeing a Duke performance at the dance festival where everyone was dressed in blackface, I started painting myself in blackface. You know, sort of a liberation for me and becoming again what I considered my authentic self, black clown, black girl. And now I've really gotten rid of all of the disguises. I don't wear wigs. I don't wear any kind of face paint. And I just paint myself because now, finally, I'm comfortable enough in my own skin to reveal who I really am.
I'm interested to hear how that process went for you, the evolution of your thought, as because you're bringing all these things together. You're developing as an artist, and you come to it relatively late. I mean, you're in college, and I guess hadn't really thought about it before then, or had you?
No.
Considered being an artist. So now here you are in college, and there's the artist who has to develop. There's the whole question of personal identity, and then the political overlay. What a racial and gender identity, which is and so deeply entwined with politics, all of which you must be thinking about as you paint. And I wonder whether at one point or another, one of these is a dominant thought.
Well, I think the identity of who I am as a woman, as a black woman, has always been a very, very thick thread throughout and still is today. I think the idea of, politically, I think, witnessing or being a part of or having to live through the KKK and live through being poor has always just made me a true underdog, an advocate for the underdog. I mean, that's something that is very, very important to me. It's in part why I am back at Central, to encourage young people who don't have a lot of things and a lot of money and a lot of art supplies to say, hey, you can't let where you've come from prevent you from success.
But in a way, what you've done to achieve that success is work through a process, which at times, was it painful trying to come to terms with these multiple identities? And then maybe facing the fact that you thought it would be better to be white, I guess, is what you were saying, right?
Yes.
And then you have to face that. Was that a difficult moment for you?
You betcha.
Yeah.
Yes, it was difficult because, basically through this process, I have had to learn to love myself just as I am. And that's always difficult. Where do you get the courage? I mean, I think in part being at Central, where I was surrounded where there were successful black people, and I was seeing black people in a different light than what I had seen in my neighborhood in Greensboro, was very helpful and very influential in helping me to say, okay, maybe it is okay to be black. So that was important. And of course, my mother, as a role model, who worked as a maid in Greensboro, who has always said, it doesn't matter what you do, but you just do it to the best of your ability. Like, I clean houses like no one else.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear you say that about Central, too, because the question periodically comes up about HBCUs, about what their value is and whether they're still relevant. But to hear you talk now, they're still vitally relevant.
They are extremely important.
Well, before you came home now, you went to graduate school at Penn State, and then you taught at Arizona State, and lived out there for a while. What kind of adjustment, was difficult adjustment for you, or easy, I guess, maybe? Leaving here sounded like something you needed to do.
Well, it was important. I mean, I'm so glad that I had 12 years in Arizona because, that's where most of my growth happened as an adult and as an artist. I mean, that's where I received the Guggenheim and the Radcliffe Fellowship and several other awards that validated me as an artist. At the same time, as a grown-up, as an individual, being in Arizona where I was the only black female art professor in, there were 60 of us total, full-time faculty members, and I was the only black female there the entire time. And I can count on one hand the number of black students that I had during that 12-year period. So, it was a really good experience for me, and it just helped develop. But it was good to leave there, too.
Let's talk about that leaving, because NC Central worked up a little trap for you.
They did.
Tell us about that. I think it's ingenious. I love it. A little underhanded, but great. So they brought you back. Tell us about it.
Yes, I was invited back to receive an honorary doctorate degree in 2007 from my alma mater. And so I returned back, and the chancellor, when I was up on stage receiving the award, he said to me, would you consider a job back here? And I thought, well, I mean, I was on stage at the time. So
this is in front of everybody.
In front of everybody. So all I could do was say, yeah, sure. And then he announced it to everybody. And he was like, you know, Beverly, we consider coming back here. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, my family was out in the audience and they were saying, yeah, right. She's not coming back. Mm-hmm. There's no way. And just a couple of weeks later, after that time, I got a call saying, were you serious about that? And I said, well, you know, I'll listen. Mm-hmm. I'll hear what you have to say.
Well, we're glad you listened. And this, by this time, you were now taking care of your sister, Renee, weren't you?
I was. I had been taking care of Renee out in Arizona for 4 years after the death of my mother. And so one of the good things about moving back to North Carolina was that there was more of a support system here for helping me with Renee. Renee's 49 years old, but she's second grade in her head. Mm. So, and she has epilepsy. So so it was difficult for me because I was, you know, having a career and traveling and, you know, going from place to place. And it was difficult because it was just me and Renee out in Arizona.
Did it affect your art when you were the sole caretaker?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
How so?
Well, you know, I start talking about what it meant to make painting, what it meant to take care of your older sister, you know, especially after the history that we had had as growing up as children where, you know, Renee was violent and, you know, it, you know, tossed me down the steps a couple of times. And so now, you know, even when my mother asked me to take care of her, I said yes, but with the idea that my mother was never going to die. You know, how you think, I mean, mm-hmm. she was completely healthy when she asked me. And I thought, well, she's going to be here forever, or I'm going to be rich enough that I could hire somebody to take care of Renee. You know, so.
But there you were. And you said for 3 years in Arizona?
It's 4 years.
4 years. To care of her. And then came back here. And you're still caring for her now. You're back here.
I am. Yeah, she lives with me in Durham.
In Durham. And then for the last 5 years, you've been followed around by a documentary film crew.
Yes, I have. West City Films, which is out of Massachusetts, has been following me and Renee and I have a film almost completed called Raising Renee, which has been purchased by HBO, which is fabulous. So so we're about to wrap it up.
Well, that's very exciting. We will be happy to see that and talk again about it. But I have to tell you something about it. We have not had a documentary film crew on this show that does anything in under 11 years. So I don't know what they told you about Almost Done. But you got another. What is that like, having a film crew following you around for 5 years?
It's very bizarre. It's really, I mean, I just pretend like they're not there.
Yeah, but that's hard to do because they've got stuff.
It is.
Lots
big
of
cameras,
stuff.
Lights. Yeah. Yes, it is. But, you know, these people are really wonderful and they've done an excellent job of, you know, being as invisible as they possibly can. And I think that they've captured, you know, the essence of what it means to, you know, be in a loving family and have a special sister with special needs and taking care of her and while maintaining an art career at the same time.
Well, part of that maintenance had to do with coming back to North Carolina and working as an artist in residence in Castle House. We're going to talk more about that with my guest, Greensboro native and artist Beverly McKeever. Coming up, Beverly is joined by the owners of Castle House. It's a unique artist-in-residence situation where she spent 6 weeks creating a series of portraits. We're going to talk about that and the creative class when the State of Things continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, Greensboro painter Beverly McKeever. She joined North Carolina Central's art department this year as an endowed professor. Her experiences from growing up in poverty to caring for her mentally disabled sister have shaped her work as a portrait artist. Beverly spent part of the summer at Castle House. Castle House is a private residence of Ellen Cassily and Frank Conhouse. It's in the woods between Durham and Orange counties. It includes an art gallery that displays their personal collection. The house also has a separate apartment and studio for guest artists. Artists from around the world are invited to paint, sculpt, write, choreograph, and simply generate ideas for upcoming projects. Beverly McKeever created a series of paintings from an upcoming show in Boulder, Colorado, while she was in residence at Castle House this summer. Ellen Castley and Frank Conhouse join us now. They operate the Castle House, and they're going to tell us more about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. Frank, you and Ellen married 5 years ago. You always knew that art would be part of your home that you made together. Tell us a little bit about this relationship and how the idea for Castle House came together.
Well, I was a photography lover and photography collector before I met Ellen. And when we got together, I mean, obviously one of the big attractions was that we both loved art and we had a lot of friends who were artists. And sort of an unexpected, at least for me, outcome of the collecting process was I got to know a lot of artists and gallery owners pretty well, and they basically became my circle of friends. And we both enjoyed being around creative people and being involved in art projects. So really, before we put a single stroke on the paper to design the house, one of the number one program items was that we'd love to have a place for artists to come and work and, you know, and be with us in the house.
And Ellen, when you have an idea like that, you can do something about it as an architect.
Thankfully, I can. Yes, it's really exciting to be able to manifest your vision and build it. And so we spent a number of years designing the house, and the artist studio was an integral part of the program. And the house is generally in two pods, as we've said, one area where we live and the other area where, which is an apartment for the artist in residence. And then there's a bridge that is a gallery that connects the two. And it's a nice metaphor for our life.
And the idea of the actual residency program, it's one thing to design a gallery, but when did you think an artist in residency program would work?
Well, very near the beginning, we have been to places like Penland in Western North Carolina, and there's so much energy that's generated with the interaction with artists, and it's exciting for us, and I think it's exciting for the artists as well.
Well, what is it like, Beverly, to work in that kind of situation when you're really, in a sense, you've got your own space, but you're in a private home? Does it change anything for you?
Well, it was a fabulous experience for me, and I got a lot of work done. I mean, I generated 9 paintings while I was there. It was very, very peaceful, and you know, anytime an artist can go to a place where the phone rings and it's not for them and the mail is not for them and, you know, you can just sort of hang out and eat popcorn for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you're bound to settle down with your thoughts and generate some new ideas.
Ellen, did I tell you I paint?
I didn't realize that. Great.
Well, I eat popcorn. But and in fact, Beverly, I mean, you talk about that, but you were actually sharing time because you were still taking care of Renee and you
That's
were living
correct.
In Durham. I mean, you had your own place in Durham, so you were spending time between places, were you?
That's correct. I would spend one night there. Every other night I would spend at Castle right. House and then go back and take care of Renee and then come back.
And still, that came as a relief, in a sense.
It was fabulous. It was fabulous.
So, Ellen, you know, you're a designer, you're an architect, artist studio. You think, hey, lots of light, right? And so you build that in.
Yes. You know, as is typical, that artists, particularly painting studios, you want a good northern light. And we have a fabulous view towards New Hope Creek. And Beverly came and she's a night owl, and she paints until 3 in the morning. There's not much natural light needed or available. So, you know, I think she painted a lot during the day as well. But that was a little bit of a surprise to me.
One of the interesting dynamics in designing the house was sort of the balance between me wanting a lot of wall space to put photographs and Ellen wanting a lot of windows for light. And you know, she ended up making a clear story all the way around the house, so we do have lots of light. Yet there's,
but way
you know, there's
the
plenty
top.
Of. And then
when, yeah. And when you do Frank audio visual design, so mm-hmm. there's a lot of ways that you can project and hear as you walk through the house as well. That's all kind of built into this the whole project.
Sure, I mean you know there's not really a significant AV system in the house, but. You know, we have music throughout the house, but it really was, for me, it was about the photography. And photography is my first love. And ironically, we haven't had a photographer yet visiting. We just assumed they would all be photographers because those are our friends. But it's been a real nice stretch for us we have a sculptor coming, and we even have a poet coming. We never really, we're sort of expanding the definition of artist in residence as we, you know, as we meet people.
Well, then how do you decide?
Well, all the folks that are coming are by invitation only. And it's people whose work intrigues us, that we want to know more about, that we want to expand our horizons with. But what's really exciting is to see how one of the few stipulations we have is to have folks reach out to the community and have some interaction, whether it's a small show or maybe they do a workshop. And that's still in development.
Yeah, that hasn't happened yet, but it's part of the plan. And I guess one of the ideas was to have art. There's a gallery as well, as you say, the space in between the artist space and yours. It's a gallery. And again, maybe a surprise was that you thought artists would love to see all this art hanging in the gallery. But no.
Well, in the gallery, yes. But it was interesting to us that both artists that we've had so far, one of the very first things they said on the first day was, would you please take the art down? It's in the artist studio. And we had gone to all this trouble to put all these photographs all over the wall. And I guess, you know, it makes sense retrospectively, but we just thought the first guy was a little, you know, it was sort of an unusual request. And then when Beverly did it, we sort of said, wow, there's a trend starting here.
Beverly?
Well, you know, those Robert Longos were just affecting me. So, I mean, I think artists want, you know, blank spaces so that they can focus on their own ideas. And so it was very nice of them to remove the photographs that were in the space so that I could, you know, think about my own, what's happening in my head.
That, I think, is a fascinating insight in a way, because what we assume about art in public spaces is that it's going to generate some, help us imagine, and it does. But the original art has to come from that blank canvas.
So you're
taking us through the entire creative process. Does it have an impact on a community? You talked about in the future asking your artists in residence to do something for the community. If not, does this have some impact on the community? Just the very fact of inviting artists into the area.
I think it does. I think as was very clear when we did a project a number of years ago with Georges Rousse, there were a number of local artists that were really affected by having him in the community, and it was very exciting.
And he did some public projects. Georges Rousse was here doing projects in Durham as downtown was coming back to life, and there were projects with schools and very public kinds of displays of his work. People get involved. What about this place attracted you? Let me ask you, Beverly, as an artist, you did come back. When you came back here, had it changed? Was the sense of a creative class? I keep using the term. I think it's vague enough for me to say it over and over, so nobody knows what I mean. Does it mean anything to you? Does it mean anything? And is there something like that that's attractive to creative people in a place like Durham or in the Triangle in general?
I think it definitely is. I mean, you know, the arts are alive and well here, and it's very different from in Greensboro where, you know, there are more galleries here and there are more art functions happening here. And the art community, I mean, I'm meeting people for the first time that I didn't know, you know, 15 years ago when I was here. So the art community is still happening and growing, and I'm just amazed at how fabulous it is to be back in Durham and have so much art and support around. And I'm grateful for Castle House because, you know, it just made it possible for me to make 9 paintings.
You have said, too, that the museum, the gallery at North Carolina Central is one of the best-kept secrets in the area. You love that place.
It totally is. I mean, Kenny Rogers is the director there, and he's doing an excellent, excellent job of, you know, bringing artists there and bringing people who are underrepresented to this community, which is great for our students and also great for the community at large.
Well, and they worked very hard to trick you into coming back. So apparently there is some commitment.
It's working. That's
it's
right.
Working. And there's a real commitment. And I wonder how much of that you feel, Ellen and Frank, about this community in terms of its, I say it is like the, like this breathing, living organ called the community, but that there is a commitment to art here that may be more palpable than other places. Help me with that.
I mean, I've been in Durham for over 30 years, and there's just something about this town. The Roos Project completely blew us away, just the having, you know, volunteers on waiting lists to get involved in this project and having 5,000 people come to the openings on a Tuesday night in downtown. I mean, when was the last time there were 5,000 people downtown?
Yeah.
It was just electric. There's just something about, there's a vibe here, and it's really attractive. And I think, it's really attractive to artists.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Alan, did you have you, as somebody who's an architect and works, again, with the creative process, did you learn much in interacting with the artists you've had so far?
Our first artist was from Switzerland, and I think there's something quite wonderful about speaking with someone that English is not their first language, because they're very descriptive in ways that you just have to rethink things a little bit. And the first night he was here, we had dinner on the screen porch. And first of all, he didn't know what a screen porch was because, of course, in Switzerland,
No bugs. Yeah.
And he thought that was an odd but delightful place. And then it started to pour down rain, and he was just astounded at how beautiful it was to be outside in the woods, dry, and hearing all this fabulous rain. And then, of course, the temperature's changing and everything.
Yeah.
And so I think it heightened our observation skills of just looking at our own surroundings through his eyes.
What did he think about Durham? How had his ideas changed over time in his being here?
Well, I don't know if he had any preconceptions about Durham at all. I think he had been to...
Oh, the Swiss are always talking about it. We're all over the front pages there.
I think he was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. And, you know, interestingly enough, Walter had just come from a really large project that had a huge exhibition and a book made about it, and he was pretty much exhausted. He had been working round the clock on this exhibition, very, very successful. And, you know, we just assume as our first artist residency, the artist's going to come and work. We were just sort of waiting for when Walter was going to start working. And instead, he basically just did a lot of journaling, did a lot of thinking, did a lot of walking. And, you know, he spent a lot of time with us. We traveled up to north of New York City to Storm King and
out to Ocracoke.
We took him to Ocracoke. We went to Dia Beacon up in New York. And it wasn't until after he left and wrote back to us and said, it's unbelievable what I got done. I basically did all of the headwork I need to
gestation.
Do for my next, the gestation of the next project. And we were saying, wow, what did we do wrong? He only did one piece. And then we realized that there are very many different experiences that are possible. But
what is that next project? Did he tell you? And does it have anything to do sort of in a real representational way with Durham or in a more abstract way that might have
actually,
had an impact?
He's been doing a lot of diptych work. The big project that he did before was a series of drawings that he then did paintings to sort of react to those drawings. And the new series is also a series of diptychs where he took some very abstract photographs, you know, where he was moving the camera very quickly. They're almost just like washes of color. And then he blew up those photographs, and he was making a response in various media, but mostly painting. And he called me over one day, and he said, Frank, I need you to look at these photographs. And I said, well, what am I supposed to do? And he said, I want you to tell me not the ones you like, but the ones that need an answer. So I just thought that was an interesting way. And I looked through them, and I reacted to certain ones. And the one that I really liked, he ended up making a gift for us of the first of that series, which was a response to that. Very abstract, but very beautiful. And again, a medium that we're not used to seeing, let alone being around when it's created. So that was really exciting.
And you're in the process of doing a documentary film yourself, or getting one started?
Just in the very beginning stages. There is a local sculptor, Patrick Doherty, and we are working.
We've seen his work at the Nasher outside, right? I said, not there anymore, but that's
not there anymore. Yeah. And he also had a piece at the North Carolina Museum of Art.
Yeah.
He will be doing four projects over the next year throughout North Carolina and South Carolina. And so we'll be working with Penelope Monsell and Kenny Dahlsheimer. And
one of the projects is at our house, actually. Patrick mm-hmm. will be in residence. He's one of our artists. Even though he lives locally, he would like to, you know, stay locally. And that, you know, that project, of course, will be filmed. And
Beverly, if your film crew ever leaves you and you get lonely, you know where to go. They'll be at the Castle House.
I should go there
still
and
a film.
Start over again.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Frank Conhouse and Ellen Cassily are the owners of Castle House, the home and studio for artists in Durham. And you can find out more information at castlehouse.typepad.com. So it's CASSILHAUS.typepad.com. Beverly McKeever, portrait artist, endowed professor of art at the University of North Carolina, North Carolina Central University. Documentary about her life called Raising Renee has been picked up by HBO. Be on the lookout for that. And thank you for listening to The State of Things. If you have a question or want to hear an archived edition, we're at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.